All right, Annabelle, I am very happy to be here for your fifth birthday party as Benjamin Franklin. Do you have any question for me, kids?
Yes, Ben, I have many questions. Is it true that you invented the bifocal?
Why, yes. I have terrible vision looking far away, and I also have different vision looking short, so I figured why not make some glasses that cover both?
Wow, my teacher also told me that you invented white supremacy, too. What about that?
My favorite color's orange. I'm not sure what you mean by white supremacy.
I'm talking about white people being better than black people.
Absolutely not. That's against our founding ideals as Americans.
Wow. Ben Franklin, I also heard that you're an author and a publisher. Is that true?
Yes.
Oh, that's very interesting. What about owning slaves? How do you feel about that?
Terrible. I thought you were going to ask me about my time in France.
Yes, but Franklin, I heard you were an ambassador to France. How did that go?
C'était excellent. J'habitais là-bas 9 ans. C'était exceptionnel. Merci.
Did you also cheat on your wife in France?
All right, kids. Well, that's enough of these tough questions for today. We're going to conclude the interview.
And scene. I totally forgot the script after we just
said... Man, you're grilling Ben Franklin over here.
Anyways, I feel like that's our modern take on how a founding father would be questioned these days, because we have just given them an onslaught of attack in regard to racism and white supremacy and their affairs.
I thought we were just recreating the Office skit, but like at a kid's birthday party when they hired a fake Ben Franklin to answer questions, but they thought he was a male stripper. Anyways,
yeah, I
didn't think we were recreating that part, but.
Yeah, not the stripping
part. Sorry, guys, that was kind of off the rails.
That's more of Taylor's weekend than it is, you know, his typical Monday.
Don't bring that into work.
Now, we opened with that because we have a new series that came out today of 5 videos featuring Dinesh D'Souza, where he goes over our different founding fathers and different things that they contributed to American society. I'm going to show you a very quick clip of that, but you can check it out by going to PragerU.com, clicking watch, and watching our latest video. This is our Making America series.
Self-made men existed before America, but they were rare. After the American Revolution, they became much more common. They came from everywhere. They are still coming. Benjamin Franklin was and remains the prototype. One of his recent biographers, Walter Isaacson, put it this way. He was the most accomplished American of his age and the most influential in inventing the type of society America would become. Franklin's life, no less than his ideas, conveyed the indomitable spirit of both invention and, just as important...
What is just as important? I don't know. You're going to have to find out by going to PragerU.com, going to watch, and watching our latest series called Making America, featuring Dinesh D'Souza. He put in a lot of work on this. 5 whole 5-minute videos, which typically we only put out 1 every Monday, but you guys got 5 today. So go and check them out to really learn something. I'm sure... even with vast amounts of knowledge, you will learn something about our founding fathers by watching this. But we have a very special opportunity today to actually listen to Dinesh D'Souza talk about his ideas that are expressed in this video. I got to interview him this morning, and let's take a look at that. Hi, everybody. So on today's program, we have a very special guest by the name of Dinesh D'Souza. He is an author, filmmaker, and host of Dinesh D'Souza Podcast. Thank you so much, Dinesh, for being on the show.
My pleasure. Looking forward to it.
Awesome. So you just came out with a large series, 5 videos, framing the founding fathers and different ways in which they were pivotal to the American experience and our founding. Now, your first video in that playlist is about Hamilton. So what I want to ask you in regard to this is that right now in American society, the left particularly is really entrenched in this idea of systemic racism and systemic oppression. And I used to be on the left. And with that, I was sort of sold the narrative that there are all these barriers set in place for me to be successful and prosperous in this country. Now, you challenged that with the history of what Hamilton did for America and said that his vision was to have as many people as possible be as prosperous as possible in America. So how do you respond to the people on the left who say that that's not the case?
Well, for Hamilton, the key question to realize is that wealth is not distributed, it is created. You know, we often hear the term redistribution. And when people say redistribution, they imply like there has been some original distribution, like someone came along and handed out the cookies, and now they're looking around and going, wow, that's an unjust distribution. We need to redistribute. Hamilton's idea is that human beings find themselves in nature, and in nature, you have abundance, but the abundance is concealed. And so, for example, think of it this way. There's a table concealed in a tree, but someone's going to cut down the wood and make it into a table. And some of nature is mysterious. You have to figure out how nature works. And that's how you get technology. You get new things that didn't exist before. So the real value that human beings bring to this is their own ingenuity, their creativity, and their hard work. That's the role of the so-called entrepreneur. So for Hamilton, wealth is created in this way, and none of us is blocked from doing it. All you have to do is think about what you can do with nature and also what people want, because after all, capitalism works on supply and demand. So for Hamilton, ultimately, we are all consumers, but we are also creators.
Amazing. But it seems as though the majority of this country, at least now with what we're feeling in regard to the government, doesn't seem to feel that way. Now, in your video on Madison, you talk about the dangers of the majority and how he warned against the tyranny of the majority. But now we hear the narrative that, well, if the majority of people believe in something, then it must be true and it must be right and it must be just. And we should defend the majority as much as possible. Why did Madison sort of defend against that idea, and why is it dangerous?
Madison understood that there's tyranny in two ways. One is the tyranny of the one or the few, and the other is the tyranny of the many. It's very important to realize that there's really no fundamental distinction between these two forms of tyranny. Think of it this way. If I'm walking to school and I've got some marbles in my pocket, and one guy jumps me and grabs my marbles, that's tyrannical. This is someone taking something from me by force. But let's say I've fallen among a gang of 10 guys, and they take a vote, and they decide that by, let's say, a vote of 7-3, that they really want my marbles. And so the 7 of them jump on me and take my marbles against my will. Or they pass a law that confiscates my marbles and turns it over to them. So for Madison, what's the difference between these two cases? Well, in principle, there's none. In both cases, somebody is being deprived of their legitimate possession, either by the force applied by the one or the force applied by the many. So this is not to say that Madison is against majority rule. Madison realizes that majority rule is sort of the least bad option. Why? Because the only alternative is minority rule. So majority rule is kind of the best we got. But in order to be legitimate, it is rule that has to be confined within certain parameters. Like the majority can do X, Y, and Z, but it can't do A, B, and C. So when the majority oversteps its bounds, that's when it's being tyrannical.
And can you explain how in our system of government we are meant to keep the minority voices alive and keep them present in our society?
So for Madison, that is done in two ways. The first way is through a Bill of Rights. And the Bill of Rights is rights asserted against the majority. In fact, rights asserted, Madison is not hesitant to say, against the people. So you have a right to speak. It doesn't matter if 99% of people don't agree with you. They don't have the right to shut you up. You have that right against the majority. And so if you look at all the provisions of the Bill of Rights, those are asserted against majority rule. But apart from the Bill of Rights, Madison believed that the architecture of the founding, separation of powers, checks and balances, the independent judiciary, these are all means to, you might say, block and tackle untrammeled majority rule.
Now, let's move on to Jefferson. And I have a feeling this is the video that you will probably get the most heat for, because you talk about what some might call the elephant in the room, although I don't think conservatives stray from this subject. You talk about slavery. Now, the left views slavery as so pivotal to the founding of America that now they've launched the 1619 Project, which asserts that the founding of this country truly happened in 1619 when the first slave ships landed in America. What is your response to that? And is Jefferson truly the big racist, white supremacist slave owner that he has been painted as?
Well, let's start with the line that Jefferson wrote in his so-called summary view, which came a little before the Declaration of Independence and reflected Jefferson's original thinking on the subject. Jefferson is attacking the crown, the King of England, for imposing slavery in America. Let's remember that between 1619 and the founding is 150 years. And Jefferson goes, we never opted for slavery. You, the British, brought it here and shoved it down our throats. And then Jefferson says the abolition of slavery, the desire to end slavery, is the shared desire of all the colonies. I mean, it's remarkable. Jefferson is saying, even as a slave owner, that the Southern territories and colonies, no less than the Northern, don't want slavery either. So, you know, if you want to grapple with Jefferson, you have to make sense of why Jefferson would do this. You can't just say, well, Jefferson was so dumb that he didn't realize that, you know, on the one hand he had slaves, on the other hand he's saying these things. Jefferson, more than you and I, realized the contradiction between what he was saying and what he was doing. But he wanted to live in a better America than the one he inherited, in his view, from the British.
So how do you think that narrative got lost? Because we know this to be true. We know that they had a plan of abolishing slavery. How have we lost that narrative in our education system?
Because when we look at the Declaration of Independence, we focus on the first part and not on the second part. So the first part is created equal. All men are created equal. Jefferson knew that. But Jefferson also knew what comes at the end of that sentence that goes missed. It's governments are instituted by the consent of the governed. Right now, here's the point, and here's the problem, and this is the American problem of the founding, which is this. What if you live in a society where the governed, the people themselves, have not given consent to total abolition? They haven't signed on to it. Now what? Now you can say, well, that's okay. We abolish slavery anyway. Well, how? You do it by running over the consent of the governed. In other words, you end democracy before it even begins. So Jefferson realized that what you have is a tension between the beginning and the end of the Declaration of Independence. And ultimately, slavery can only be ended when the consent of the governed comes into harmony with created equal. Now, that did not happen until the Civil War. It didn't happen until two generations after Jefferson. So Jefferson was trying to figure out, how do we create a system in which we can be true not only to the principle of equality, but also to the principle of democracy?
Yeah, that's a very important point, is that all the founding fathers were trying to be true to that principle of equality. They were trying to be virtuous. Now, in your video on John Adams, you focus a lot on his sentiment of being virtuous. And some might say that the left and John Adams sort of have this in common. They view virtue as something being very, very important. But the left nowadays views virtue as somehow being synonymous with being compliant and being empathetic towards people in an extreme way, something they've coined as radical empathy. How is the left's view of virtue and John Adams' view of virtue different?
John Adams' view of virtue is neither the view that you sometimes hear on the right of virtue as identified, you could almost call it with female chastity. So in other words, the virtue of abstinence, the virtue of pro-life. We think of virtue kind of in that family of issues as almost a feminine virtue. But for Adams, virtue was actually a masculine idea. And by masculine, all I mean, I don't mean it's confined to men. What I mean is he's talking about civic virtue. He's talking about, for example, being a responsible citizen. He's talking about how do you develop an attachment to things larger than yourself. How do you develop an attachment to family, to community, let's say to the Little Leagues and the Boy Scouts? How do you develop an attachment to your country that's going to make you care about the larger good, the public good, and not just your own good? So virtue is defined that way. But this is an energetic virtue that involves personal striving. It's not the kind of posturing that the left is all. I mean, in the left, what you have is you have some guy like Bill Clinton, who's essentially, in personal terms, absolutely disgusting. But he goes, well, yeah, but I'm in support of the Equal Rights Amendment. You know, or you even have a LeBron James who's like makes $70 million a year. But he goes, you know, I'm oppressed compared to a white, you know, taxi driver. Really? So what you have is virtue has taken on a twisted and bogus quality on the left. It's not the genuine virtue that Adams cared about.
So how do you think we reinvigorate that idea of John Adams' virtue in America? Because it's seemingly lost on a large portion of our citizens.
It's hard to get it back because
In the original form, you have a civic attachment to people who are like yourself. You know, in other words, it's difficult to develop the civic attachment to strangers. And so the only way to do that is when you begin to feel that those strangers are now your fellow citizens. So the problem with this kind of fractured, divided America we have is that we look at the left and we go, you know, your America isn't even our America. So why would we be willing to die for your America? No more than you'd be willing to die for ours. And so when you have this breakdown, the left in a way doesn't know what it's doing. What it's doing is it's creating an America in which the bonds of common citizenship are being very seriously frayed. And it's going to cause people right and left to kind of turn in on themselves and only promote their own group.
You're absolutely right. And when we speak about civic attachment to strangers, it reminds me of our next father, and that is Benjamin Franklin, the great diplomat, the author, the publisher, the inventor. Now, he's done so many things. Some may even call him a master of all trades. But what do you think was Ben Franklin's most important contribution to the American governance and American society?
Well, Ben Franklin was, a Renaissance man. Now, he wasn't the only Renaissance man. Thomas Jefferson was the Renaissance man. Jefferson was an inventor, a diplomat, a writer. He had this wide, kind of an anthropologist. But Franklin was a philanthropist. He was a printer. He was an entrepreneur. He was a diplomat. He was also this kind of, he did scientific experiments in electricity. So he's this varied guy. But I would argue that his greatest invention is himself. So to put it differently, it's self-invention. And if you think about it, this is really a very core American idea. The notion that your own life is a script in which you are the author, you won't find that in any other country. Even if you go to Europe, the idea is, well, you're a Frenchman. You're not supposed to be all that different from other Frenchmen. Yeah, you have your own name and so on, but you got to, eat croissants and speak the French language and appreciate. But the idea that your own life is distinctively yours and you're in the driver's seat of it. Franklin not only believed that, he lived that. And so he becomes the embodiment of the self-made man. Now, later, there are other self-made men in American history. For example, Frederick Douglass, who actually went around the country giving speeches called the self-made man. Frederick Douglass was himself a self-made man. Runaway slave. He becomes a diplomat. He becomes a famous writer and speaker. So he's in the Franklin tradition. But the mold, the original self-made man, in my view, was, in fact, Benjamin Franklin.
Well, amazing. Dinesh, I want to thank you so much for being on the show. As everybody watching, if you want to hear more about what he's saying about these founding fathers, you can go to his series on PragerU.com called Making America. I encourage you to watch the entire playlist. There is such a large wealth of knowledge available in those videos. And you should also support Dinesh by, one, buying his books, and two, listening to his podcast, the Dinesh D'Souza Podcast. Now, Dinesh, I want to end on one thing. So let's assume that nobody sees these videos. What is one thing you want everybody to leave with from the founding fathers that they should remember and carry with them through their daily lives?
Well, the American founders wanted to create a new kind of society. And when we think about the American Revolution, it's really the only successful revolution in world history. There have been many other revolutions, notably the French Revolution, but the French Revolution ended in what's called the Terror, where ultimately Napoleon comes in as the emperor. That's the end of the French Revolution. The Russian Revolution, a disaster. Mao's Cultural Revolution, a disaster, and many other smaller disasters. So the American Revolution has now endured for 200 years, but seems to me, its ultimate success remains an open question. So at a time when we're wondering, like, do those old principles that go back to 1789, do they still apply today? We're not an agricultural society. We have all this technology. We have a different society today. What do the founders have to say to us? And my answer in these videos, and I have to condense them because I've got 5 videos, but I think if you watch all 5, you actually get a comprehensive picture of the sort of philosophical statesmanship that goes into the founding, the architecture of the founding, and you can see how that vision, even though dimmed, should not be lost because it has a lot to say to us today.
Don't let it be lost, ladies and gentlemen. Dinesh, thank you so much for being on Will and Amala Live. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
What a fun interview. Big guest, by the way. Dinesh was really pivotal in me changing my mind from left to right, all those many, many years ago.
Many months.
Yeah, all those many months ago when that all happened. But he talks about something important, and that there's this massive effort to reshape history and tell it in a light that is not accurate and really lacks nuance and lacks the subtleties of true history. And when we start to retell history, especially that of the Founding Fathers, and we miss those subtleties, we miss everything that is so important to what they did for this country, you're really doing everybody a disservice.
Yeah, his videos are great. I mean, we watched all five of them already, and they're out now on PragerU.com. But I actually learned things that I had not learned before. Like, if you would have asked me just cold turkey, what was Madison's contribution, or what was and mm-hmm. he takes a very unique angle with Madison, Hamilton, even Adams. Ben Franklin about right. the self-made man, Adams. And so yeah, I mean, they were really educational videos, and who knew PragerU makes awesome content that you can actually learn good things from. That's
who knew
accurate history. So.
If only they had some personalities to talk about that content. Yeah. Now, what that sort of historical context is battling against is things like the 1619 Project. And if you don't think that this is something that is happening, let's look at this video out of CNN with Brian Stelter and Nicole Hannah-Jones talking about the 1619 Project.
I think we're going to look back someday and say, wait, they tried to ban the 1619 Project. Like we're going to look back. We're just going to it's going to make no sense in 30 or 40 years. But is this just the white lash in another form, Nicole? Just, you know, some white Americans afraid to deal with the reality, so they don't want to hear it, so they try to ban it, and then someday their kids are going to laugh it off?
I mean, I don't know. I think that this is a particularly dangerous moment, because there's one thing to have right-wing media saying they don't like the 1619 Project, they don't agree with the 1619 Project, but it's quite something else to have politicians from state legislators down to school boards actually making prohibitions against teaching a work of American journalism or really any of these other texts. The fact that we are all talking about this fake controversy called critical race theory really speaks to how successful the public propaganda campaign has been.
Fake controversy. I don't think that's true. I don't think that's accurate at all. When you have a theory that purports that white people carry more power and privilege than black people do, when Taylor and Scott have more opportunities than I have, and that's the basis of your theory. No, I think the controversy isn't false at all. I think it's very real controversy.
She's calling this a propaganda effort when your project, the 1619 Project, is literally a propaganda effort to rewrite American history around slavery being the founding of it. That's literally what it claims, which she tweeted that's what it claims, and then she claimed it didn't. She didn't claim that, and then there was written evidence saying that's exactly that it was her own words used against her. So, these are the propagandists, and the irony of her coming on here saying that, asking for an accurate representation of American history and fighting against her misrepresentation of it is propaganda.
Right. And she says, oh, well, it's so dangerous to speak out against the 1619 Project. What's dangerous is to forget our founding. Because those are principles that if we lose, we've lost our governance, the best system of governance that has ever existed thus far. So you tell me what's more dangerous, Nicole Hannah-Jones. Calling out the 1619 Project or losing the founding of this country. And you know what? Let's discuss school board bans of the 1619 Project. Do I think that no student should ever hear that the 1619 Project exists or that it's something that somebody has written? Absolutely not. I think it's totally fine that people learn that the 1619 Project is a piece of work that exists.
Yeah.
The difference is she's saying that we should teach it as fact.
Yep.
And that's the problem, because it's not.
It's the same thing with critical race theory. They always, it's the same argument every time, is that you want to whitewash American history. You don't want to teach the ugly parts of American history. And then they come up with some fringe examples of like some random person somewhere that actually tried to whitewash history. But they're circumventing the actual argument, which is you're indoctrinating young people with racist propaganda that tells young black people that they're victims and young white people that they're oppressors and teaches them a false misconstruction of American history. You're the ones promoting this stuff, and we're simply asking for factual and balanced presentation of U.S. history.
Yeah, and now they have a new term that they've coined for this, for people that call out the 1619 Project and critical race theory. It's called whitelash.
Yeah.
It's called whitelash instead of backlash, whitelash, if you call out these projects. Last time I checked, I'm only half white, so what do you call it when I call it the 1619 project? What is that called? Half lash?
Gray lash.
Because I don't get it. And still, it amazes me. No matter how often your theories are debunked and your information is discredited, that you can still get on public television and defend the things that you believe without any nuance, without any actual response to criticism of what you actually believe.
The irony of Brian Stelter's CNN show being called reliable sources is not lost on me at all.
It's amazing. It's amazing. Yeah, and that's what we're battling against, is that right there, coupled with the fact that we get censored for speaking out against it, and we get called white lashers for speaking out against it. A beautiful term. I think I'm going to add that to my very own lexicon. Now, we have a personal experience with this, which is a story we're going to get into regarding Will and his experience trying to speak on campuses. But first, let's check in with Will. Where's Will Witt? For those of you who don't know, Will is on his book tour right now, How to Win Friends and Influence Enemies. You can buy it anywhere books are sold. And, you know, he's out there talking to the masses, going to different colleges and universities, speaking about his book, about the premise of his book, and about the work that he's doing here at PragerU. But we all knew that it was very important for him to check in with you and let you know what he's doing. So here's a little quick check-in from Will Witt.
Live viewers, Will Witt here. I am in New York City right now. I got my first event tonight at 6:30 p.m. in New York City at St. John's University. My first book tour stop. There's going to be books there for me to sign. People are going to be able to buy them. It's going to be great. Look, I'll show you. Look at that. Isn't New York just the most amazing place in the entire world? Until you walk into a Chipotle and they say, you can't eat here because you don't have your papers. So, yeah, not enjoying it too much being in New York, but I still got to do a lot of fun stuff and do a lot of media here. That's why I was here. So I'm loving New York and wish you guys could be here and wish I could be on the show a little bit more. But I'll be on for some other segments this week, but just keeping you updated. And tomorrow I am in Washington, D.C. Peace, guys.
So Will is just a world traveler these days, going around pushing his book. So hopefully he's successful, although he's had some hiccups.
This is true.
He has had some hiccups, and one that we're going to get into right now. He's planning on doing a speech at UMD, where he goes and for a TPUSA event talks to people about his book. But look at this. Look at this post from Will on Instagram. No hate at UMD. Turning Point USA is inviting fellow bigot and PragerU associate Will Witt to our campus. PragerU and Turning Point USA have a history of spreading hatred to marginalized communities. Be safe, bring noisemakers, and come peacefully. Join your fellow students in solidarity.
At least they're coming peacefully with noisemakers.
Yeah. Right, right. Peaceful noisemakers.
We're just going to annoy you to death.
Right. Yeah. Will has had this experience before where he's gone to speak somewhere and people have shown up in mass and flipped tables, screamed at him, banged on the walls and the tables to make sure that nobody could hear him speak. And I have a feeling he's going to have a very similar experience here at UMD. Now, can anybody name a leftist speaker who has ever been shut down from going to speak to a college or a university?
No. And why is that?
Because we invite dialogue. Interestingly enough, as Jordan Peterson would say, dialogue is the avenue to truth, and conservatives invite that dialogue. Yet when conservatives try to go to campuses like UMD, they get this. People who come to make noise, to drown out the sound of your thoughts so nobody can hear what you have to say.
Yeah, I mean, if you believe the facts are on your side and the truth is on your side, you have the better arguments, then you're not threatened by ideas.
Right.
And this is just, again, a reflection of this generation that is being raised in a way that they're so coddled that they're being taught to be afraid of ideas. And you have trigger warnings and safe spaces. And when a speaker comes to campus with ideas that differ from the norm, and I love how they frame this, like, you know, what do they call them? Fellow bigot and PragerU
associate.
And then what did they claim? He has a history of
spreading hate and marginalizing communities.
I would love if like Will would just ask for one of their representatives to come up and ask them for one example of him spreading hate against marginalized communities.
Right.
Or PragerU doing so.
Please.
I guarantee they would not be able to come up with anything.
And they can't. And that's been the experience that Will has had over and over. Every time he goes and confronts people, which he does very often, as is his line of work doing Man on the Street, nobody can ever give a valid example of anything that he's done, anything that PragerU's done, to actually spread hate or marginalize a group of people. Yet the narrative is so deep within these people's minds that they can't even have somebody come and speak. And his whole book, funnily enough, is about creating dialogue, how to speak with people, how to change their minds. Yet they won't even allow that to happen on their campus. So UMD, good job. And guess what? Another development on that. Now, TPUSA and Will are being forced to provide security for their own event because these students came and wanted to create trouble and wanted to create a disruption.
So the university is essentially saying, we're not willing to guarantee your safety as a speaker on our campus. We're not able to provide that. So you're going to have to provide security at your own expense, which is what happened with Ben Shapiro, too, by the way, at Berkeley, wasn't it?
Yeah. Amazing that a university is not going to take responsibility for its own, you know, its own students that are misacting. And I'm sure they're going against some sort of bylaws within the university's code. And the university is not going to take responsibility for that because Will's a conservative and he's coming to talk about conservative ideals and they won't protect him because of that.
But you see how this connects to what you asked Dinesh D'Souza about virtue.
Right.
And the people who are going in there with noisemakers and prepared to bang on tables and silence Will Witt are doing so out of a sense of virtue. They have castigated Will as this evil, bad person who's spreading racism, and we are just going to go and silence him and make sure he doesn't have a voice, and this is our righteous duty to kick this out. The problem is they're completely off base, and there's nothing that their entire premise is false.
Yeah.
But they don't care about facts. And so they skip over the facts and they skip over the truth and they skip over being able to listen to someone with a different point of view. It's like this instinctual, you know, we must retreat into, oh, that guy's not conforming with us. It's the same thing we're seeing with like the vaccine mandates and all this type of stuff. Like, oh, we have to impose our one the right way on everyone else, like you see in Australia, do the right thing. You hear this so often, and it's this like false sense of virtue that comes from conformity, and I hate that conflation.
Yeah, and look at, I mean, this happened with nearly every single conservative political commentator. They go through the same exact experience, all while trying to just share their ideals. Look at Jordan Peterson at the University of Toronto when he tried to speak out against Bill C-16, and all these students came and were blaring speakers, trying to talk, and eventually he got them to stop and just had to scream his speech because of these students. And that's what Will's going to have to do. And it's super unfortunate because if we just had the dialogue, I'm sure they would find that he's perfectly friendly. He's not trying to spread hatred or marginalize anybody. I feel extremely marginalized whenever Will is on this podcast. It's just
he literally has a show with a POC.
Right.
And
oh
yet he's someone
gosh.
Who marginalizes.
Yeah. I feel like
I
have
even
to
like
go
to play
there.
Those games, but it's
I
just
know.
The irony is so obvious.
It is so blatantly obvious, and it's still it happens. But we're not going to allow Will to be silenced. We will play his videos here on our stream. And one of those videos is Will on Glenn Beck. So let's have a listen.
We're not headed towards Marxism. We're headed towards an oligarchy that has parts Marxist, you know, no capitalist stuff unless it's just completely corrupt and selected by the elites.
And it's crazy because, you know, you look back in the 60s and 70s and you would have people on the left and they were the anti-big business
Correct.
People. They were the working class people. They were against illegal immigration. Cesar
yes.
Chavez, against illegal immigration because he knew that it hurt union wages.
Mm-hmm.
But now it's like the right. Are moving into this group. Some of the people on the right are moving into this group where we are starting to realize what it is, and the people on the left now have Google and Apple on their t-shirts.
It's bizarre.
They love these corporations.
Yeah, I think these people, especially, I said this on the air the other day, I think people who grew up in the 60s, you the younger version of you would hate who you've turned into. You know what I mean? Because you're against everything you used to be for, and yet you still think you're for it, and it's bizarre.
Awesome. So that's what Will's been up to. We had to go ahead and check in with him because I know you guys miss him on the program. Now, another story involving Will and Taylor, which kind of came out of left field on Twitter, which was interesting. Let's look at these tweets here. Taylor Trandall, Taylor Trandall tweeted out, taking the wife to Chili's tonight. I couldn't be more excited.
I just thought it was such a funny, like, tweet, the thing to tweet, like, being excited. You don't understand, like, in LA, we don't really have Chili's. I mean, they're not close. You know, you have to, like, go out of, like, Los Angeles proper to, like, suburbs to even get the normal American experience of, like, you know, your typical just chain restaurants and everything. So that's, like, exciting for me. It's a breath of fresh air. So anyways, I was like, I like to lean into it and just be the cheesy dad joke, but, like,
yeah,
taking the wife to Chili's tonight in my New Balance sneakers right after I mow the lawn, and here we go. But
you got an unexpected response, and one was from Will Witt. Will Witt responded, "The only place to chill."
Will's very charitable with responding and liking to my tweets to my 400 followers or whatever.
But then Chili's Bar and Grill responded by saying, "Spoken like a true fan, hashtag we heart Will." Is Chili's Bar and Grill based? Do they love conservative commentator Will Witt?
Apparently. I mean, unless it's just like the social media manager sneaking that in there, like, you know, they happens to be a fan and they're like,
yeah,
we heart Will. But why else would you put that on there? I mean, there's no other reason. They must be a fan of Will Witt. And that's really cool that they were tweeting that.
I love how we see that as a brave statement now that Chili's came out and put hashtag we heart Will. Like, we think that's so
stunning,
significant.
And
stunning and brave. And a stunning and brave move from Chili's and an act of activism.
But yeah, what wasn't so great was the fact that the restaurant, thanks to California's amazing policies and national policies that we have, this restaurant was extremely understaffed, and there were, like, we counted like 15, 16 tables open, but they just did not have enough staff, and we would have had to wait an hour to seat at our neighborhood Chili's. So we ended up checking Red Lobster, and they had the exact same situation in the same parking lot. So we weren't able to. The epic conclusion to the story is we ended up ordering on Postmates TGI Fridays to our friend's house where we were hanging out. So we got it one way or another, but yeah, sad day.
It is a sad day, and that is the state of the American.
I'm surprised the mob hasn't come after Chili's though yet.
I know. I was like,
endorsing the racist bigot that is.
You know, that one hashtag, we heart Will, is cancelable in its nature. I think it's part of the wokest code there, that if you come out in endorsement of Will Witt, your head's on the shopping block. You're in the guillotine.
That's true. Real quick, Gnarly Sheen asks, what does based mean?
Based means you're aware, you know what's going on, you're conservative, and you're just well-educated, well-rounded. You just know the inner workings of what's happening in this
country.
Whatever
the opposite of woke is based.
Right. When you're not woke, you're based. Now, speaking of based, we have more celebrity news. And this is another singer by the name of Rihanna. I'm sure you guys know her. I'm sure some of you love her. Let's take a look at this photo here of Rihanna. Look at what she's wearing in this t-shirt. Think while it's still legal. Rihanna came out repping this t-shirt. We're seeing this on the heels of what has happened with Nicki Minaj, her getting backlash for speaking out and just her opinions and concerns about COVID-19 and the COVID vaccine in particular. But now we got Bad Gal Riri wearing this t-shirt and getting photographed in it, which is very, very cool. I think we're seeing a flip in Hollywood right now, or at least a schism in Hollywood, because now we have Nicki Minaj, who came out, last week, week and a half. We had Johnny Depp after that, who spoke out against cancel culture. Now we have Rihanna.
Daniel Craig talking about
Craig.
Not making women's roles for men.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, people that maybe is the last bastion of sanity somehow going to come out of Hollywood. How ironic would that be? But it's the culture has gotten so aggressive, and the you must conform and think the way that we think, or you know, the right way, that I think there's a lot of them who have been afraid to speak up, and because they didn't want to lose roles or whatever, who are now at the point where they're like, you know what, I don't care anymore. I'm just going to speak my mind, and good on them. I hope it continues. I hope the trend continues.
Yeah, I hope so too. And I think at some point you amass a certain amount of success, which makes you uncancelable. And I think Rihanna and Nicki Minaj and Johnny Depp and Daniel Craig are obviously all within that category. So hopefully that success gives you a little bit of wiggle room and a little bit of flexibility to actually speak your mind and share your views. And because they're celebrities, they don't get restricted. Now, speaking of restrictions, we have a new short documentary coming out.
What a transition.
I know, that was a smooth transition. You gotta tell me. We have a new short documentary coming out by PragerU, by the name Restricted. Let's go ahead and show you guys this trailer. It'll be coming out soon.
Facebook demonetized my page for the high crime and misdemeanor.
Telling me that I have been
locked out of my account.
That account
is suspended by Google.
We got suspended off Facebook.
I became very insecure with the reliability of YouTube and all the platforms. I was seeing so many people get their videos censored.
This is not just an issue for PragerU. It's not just an issue for content creators. It's certainly not just an issue for those on the right. This is an issue for all citizens who believe that they should hear the truth and make their own decisions about things.
And yes, that is the trailer for our new documentary, Restricted, where we talk about online censorship, a personal battle for PragerU and all of our personalities here, but also just a personal battle for a lot of people. And it doesn't matter, like Marissa says, it doesn't matter what side of the line you fall on. Censorship is a looming problem for both sides, and it's going to get worse if we do not come out and fight against it. So,
yeah, I'm really glad we're making this. Like, I mean, it's the same ideology that is making big tech crack down on free speech that is driving the people to go protest Will's speech today at this university. You know, it's this idea of conformity. Do not question the mainstream narrative. You mm-hmm. must think this way. You must not question, quote unquote, the experts. You must, quote unquote, follow the science, all this stuff. And this new documentary really takes a look at how that's being played out in the world of big tech and the outsized amount of power they have to control what you're even able to see in the first place online.
Yep.
And so definitely give it a watch and continue watching us and sharing this, because they are definitely not giving us the viewership that we deserve. And we're noticing that, you know, we're under the thumb of big tech all the time, and, you know, help us out by engaging with our content, sharing it, and continue to tune in. Subscribe, text live to, what's the number again?
41776, text live to 41776.
We are trying to get that up and running actually this week. So, and we have a great lineup of guests coming up this week with Zuby and
Dave
Zuby Rubin.
Music and Dave Rubin.
So who needs Will Witt? Just kidding. We had to bring in the big guns in his absence to kind of pull, you know, carry the load.
Yeah, and those episodes are coming this week, so make sure you guys tune in. We're going to be sharing them. Yeah, we have some big names coming on this podcast. We're calling in the reinforcements while Will is gone. Now, typically on Mondays, we do a segment called Dear Will and Amala, and while it still is underneath that moniker, Will is not here, so we're bringing in reinforcements. I have Taylor Trandall, of course, which you guys are all familiar with, who's going to come in and also give you advice. And we also have Scott.
I will do my best.
Scott will do his best. So,
and look good doing it.
You submitted your advice questions through my Instagram at the Amala Epinobi. You can follow me on Instagram there. You can follow Will at the Will Witt. You can follow Taylor at Taylor Trandall. And yeah, every day we put out little prompts for you guys to answer to, and we feature your Instagram handles on our show. So starting off, Dear Will and Amala, or I guess Dear Amala, Taylor, and Scott, how do I deal with somebody who wants to constantly argue or tries to get the last word? And this is from Tyrevard20 on Instagram.
Someone who wants to constantly argue.
Mm-hmm. And tries to get the last word.
Well, first of all, I don't know what your level of, like, I just avoid people like this. Mm-hmm. As a general rule, because most of the time, if someone's extremely argumentative, just as a personality trait, like they're not really interested in having conversations with you that are constructive, where you both can learn from each other, and they're interested in your point of view. They've decided what they've decided, and they're trying to impose that on you. Mm-hmm. So I'm not really interested in having conversations like that. So I usually just avoid them. So either avoid them or win the argument.
Yeah, yeah. I would say normally people who are involved in this sort of activity are either A, narcissistic, and it's an ego problem where they have to get the last word and they have to constantly feel like they've one-upped you on something that you've said, or they have an insecurity problem, the exact opposite, where they feel sort of short or undercompensated in those areas and try to overcompensate for that. So there's no reason to entertain that, especially if it's not getting you anywhere with dialogue and it's creating a bad situation for yourself. But if you are going to continue to engage with this person and talk to them and get into these arguments where they try to get the last word, do not give them a rise. That's what people like this thrive off of, is getting a rise out of you and knowing, well, I've crushed and defeated this person. And that makes me feel better, whether I'm insecure or whether I'm narcissistic. So just don't give it the time of day.
Yeah, so. I would agree with that. You know, they're in it to win, first and foremost. Mm-hmm. And when you're in a conversation, it really shouldn't be a competition. It should be the honest exchange of ideas, going back and forth. So if you do feel like somebody is just jumping on you and trying to win that conversation, you know, you have the power to let it be known that you're going to walk away and just be like, look, this is no longer a conversation I'm willing to have.
Right.
Because it's dishonest.
Right.
And you just need to be frank, and let them know that. And, as Taylor said, if you have a an argument that needs to be made, make it. And if they can't listen to it, then yeah.
Yeah, not your problem. Not your problem, Ty. Just, start off, are we looking for truth or are we looking to win? And if you're looking to win, probably not. Probably not your battle. Probably not your battle. Next one. Dear Will and Amala, there's a girl on my campus ministry I'd like to ask out, but I can never get a moment alone to do it. Do I shoot my shot in the open or try something else? And this is from Jay Donahue II.
Kiss her.
just
somebody has to say that while Will is gone.
To say it, but
Will goes, just kiss her.
No, I think, you don't want to embarrass her, but you should not be intimidated by the presence of other human beings, or else if you wait for the perfect opportunity, it may never come. So I would say, if you're finding that she's never alone, I would say shoot your shot. Try to be sensitive and not embarrass her, but don't let your fear of other people watching you hold you back. Like, it's the power move, is to go make your move.
Yeah. Go ahead, Scott.
Yeah, I would say that also shows just a form of confidence. And if she's, you know, at least semi-interested in you, that's only going to increase that interest. If you approach her with her friends around and you're just bold and you
exactly. Think of how many, like, you know, Disney shows or romantic movies or whatever, where the guy just like rolls up while the girl's doing her thing at her locker with her friends or whatever. And he's just like, will you go to the prom with me or whatever? And boom, that swagger is just factor just kicks
exactly.
in. So
yeah, there's always also the very simple, do you have a second to talk over here for a second? Do you want to, can you get away from the crowd for a minute and just do that? That's a public stance, but it's not publicly saying in front of a bunch of people that you're interested in this girl and you want to date her. There's always the quick, hey, can I talk to you for a second? and that'll be fine. And if she rejects you, you can just sort of bow out without anybody knowing what you talked about. If you're too shy to actually do it out in the open, that's a, you know, win-win. Yeah.
Can I take you down this dark alley for a quick No, that's a great note.
Yeah. You ever been to the haunted house across the street? Just want to talk to you for a second. next one here. Dear Will and Amala, my industry is saturated with leftists. How to stay sane when surrounded by people I dislike? And this one's from Neela Shimi. Now, Scott and I talked about this at lunch.
Yeah, this is a very difficult one, and I was talking to Amala before I joined PragerU here. I was very much in that exact same situation, and I was lucky enough to have found the love of my life, and you know, speak with her and find our our world together, where we can fight through these situations together, and have discussions open and honest. So I was lucky in that sense. But if you're not as lucky at this moment in time, I would say, you know, it's a battle. It's a personal battle that you have to be willing to fight. You have to wake up every day ready to fight that fight. Try and find the courage within yourself to have open discussions with people, to see if you can find those like-minded individuals that you can share this stress with and open up to them. But the only way you're going to find them is if you put that effort forward.
Yeah.
And put yourself out there. So it's kind of in the same sense where we were talking about going and talking to the girl. Hey.
Yeah.
You got to do it.
I can nearly guarantee you're not completely surrounded by leftists. It's funny because I go through these experiences where I'll show up places, and I'm sure Will gets this too. And people walk up to him and they go, well, I I work somewhere and there's all these leftists and blah, 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 but we love your videos. And I'm just like, well, say that to somebody at your work. And I'm sure somebody else does. I'm sure there's somebody else that's a conservative. Yeah, I had one experience recently where I was at a hospital and a doctor walked up to me and was like, there's a small group of people here that really loves PragerU and watches all your videos. And he's like, I can't say it that loud, but we all watch your stream and we all watch Will and Amala Live and we watch your TikToks and all this stuff. And you sort of find your little oasis of people that have, you know, free thought and are like-minded, and it makes work a little more bearable if you can't obviously leave that job and do something else.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I would say like, If you're allowing your knowledge that people that have different political views than you to completely make you cut them off, if it makes you angry just by knowing that there's people who disagree with you that you have to be around every day, I would kind of say some of that can be on you as well.
Mm-hmm.
You have the choice to like choose to rise above that. And like, I would say most people, unless you're working at like BuzzFeed or New York Times or somewhere super woke, most people are not, you know, blue-haired activists raging 24/7 about this stuff to where all they think about is, if that is the case, then yeah, I really sympathize with you and that. I don't know how you ended up at the job where you're surrounded by activists, but I would say most people are pretty normal and there's plenty of opportunity to connect with people on a human level and try to increase the shared space that we have in society. And I mean, so many people listen to people like Joe Rogan. Some people watch sports. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of, I mean, I'm talking guy stuff, but there's a lot of things you can connect with people over, Hollywood movies, whatever, that you know, that will take some of the tension out of those relationships. And like, if you're the only one that's cutting them off just because you know of their political views, then I would say that there's a better way to go about that to make life more easy on you. Don't let it, you know, rise above. Don't let it ruin your whole life.
Yeah, it shouldn't ruin your friendships. That's something that the other side does. Like, don't let that be the case. You can have friends who have differing political beliefs than you and still enjoy life outside of those things. Just like you can have family that has differing political beliefs than you and rise above that and still have a great connection.
What do you know about that, Amala?
Yeah. What could I possibly know about having a connection with a family member who's an extreme leftist? Absolutely nothing. Now, this next question is, you know, something that's happening for a lot of parents right now. Dear Will and Amala, my 8th grade son's teacher is displaying the BLM and Pride flags. Best way to address it? This is from Moto Mule.
Talk to her. Talk to the principal. Go to the school board meeting. Ask him to also have a Blue Lives Matter flag or something like that. Mm. I don't know. I mean, there's lots of things you can do, but it starts with doing something. And, you know, be respectful. You don't need to march in there and make a huge list of demands or whatever, but, you know, engage them honestly and say, hey, what's the spirit behind this? Are we giving a balanced view in my classroom, my child's classroom? I'm concerned about this. Like, and see where that conversation leads.
Yeah. Be strategic too. This is not typical. I would say not yet of classrooms, although it is becoming more and more typical. Find out if your administrators at your school know that this is happening. Yeah. Know that this, see if they've come and checked out the classrooms, which they should be doing on a fairly regular basis. See if they know that these flags are hanging up in your 8th grade son's classroom. Go from there. Does the school board know that this is happening? And then, you know, work your way up the hierarchy and see where all this is actually stemming from. And that's where the battle really starts. But at the very basis, definitely talk to the administrators and see if they know if this is happening and call out that teacher, because that's obviously not right.
Yeah, I would agree. You just have to be upfront with it and go in and speak to those that are in charge to make sure that they're aware of it. And I'd also say it's somewhat of your civic duty. You're a taxpaying citizen. If things are not running the way that you would like, especially as it comes to your children, you have to be their champion.
Yeah.
And make sure that they're, you know, they're doing well by the schools. And that's most important.
And spread the word among other parents who, you know, who are like-minded, try to find them. And, you know, you're stronger together and you're a bigger problem for the administration if there are more voices that sign on to it. So, you know, but like Scott's saying, like, you know, I think there's a lot. I mean, we're regaining it. We're seeing a lot of parents re-engage with their local communities and school boards and start to make demands and bands together. But I think for a long time that we've like fallen asleep at the wheel as Americans and really just not been engaged in our local government, local communities and not made sure that we are represented. And that's what America is all about, is being a representative democracy. And so now that it's a lot of the institutions, I think we're infiltrated as we were asleep at the wheel, and it's time we're not sleeping sleeping anymore. It's time to engage and get make your voice heard and make it so that we're your values, your interests, your beliefs are represented.
Right. And lastly, assume that when you see something wrong, you're the only person who knows that it's wrong and you're the only person capable of doing something about it. So often we fall victim to the bystander effect of, oh, I recognize that this is happening and that's horrible, but somebody else will take care of it. Or there's other parents that are outraged. It's not just me. Yeah. Maybe a student will call it out and go to the principal. No, just assume that none of that is going to happen. Just assume that you are the only and the loudest voice that could possibly take care of this problem and then go and take care of it. Because a lot of the reason that we're in the problems that we are in right now is because of that bystander effect. Because people actively saw, oh, well, that's not right, but somebody else will take care of it for me. My representatives will take care of it for me. The administration will take care of it for me. The government will take care of it for me. And they don't. They don't. So you have to be that person when you recognize something. Now, here's the last one. Dear Will and Amala, how do I answer somebody who says I'm oppressed because I am a stay-at-home mom? And this is from Anastasia Apais, I think is how you
I did not know that was the abbreviation for stay-at-home mom.
Yeah, I didn't know. I didn't know at first. I had to think about it. I was like, what is this an abbreviation for? I didn't realize there was an abbreviation for stay-at-home mom. But obviously you're not. Come on, Anastasia. And that's your best answer, is absolutely not. I'm not oppressed. And think about it this way. You are contributing to society. You are building the strongest bond that you can in a nation, and that is a family. And you are really the sole proprietor of all of the wonderful things that get out of that. So who cares what other people think about what you're doing? Just continue to do what you're doing. And the fact that anybody could look at that and see oppression in it is just beyond me. But just stand your ground. You're doing something great. You are raising the next generation of Americans, and I'm assuming you're doing it well if you're concerned about what somebody has to say about what you're doing.
Yeah, if you're oppressed, then you're not doing what you freely choose to do.
Yep.
And I would say, isn't you imposing your view of what is acceptable for a woman to do? Isn't you imposing your view that a woman should remain single and into her late 20s or whatever and be the strong, independent woman? Isn't that oppressing me from freely making the choices? Like, you need to respect my freedom and independence as a woman and to choose for myself what's going to make me happy and what's going to fulfill me, and that's none of your business.
Right. Yeah. What would you rather? Would you rather somebody else raise my children? what would you prefer? What is the best alternative to the oppressive nature of being a stay-at-home mom? Because I don't know the answer to that. You are honestly doing one of the greatest things that you can do as a woman, and I'm sure that you are doing it well. So don't listen to these people.
Yeah, that would be an immediate excuse you.
Yeah.
Kind of reaction.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would say that stay-at-home moms are honestly a gift. In this day and age, they are the vanguard in this entire cultural battle. Like you said, they're raising a generation of kids who will be growing up in this battlefield.
Yep.
And the only way that things will get better is if the generations that are growing up right now are taught good values and how to defend themselves, defend their ideas, and how to grow up as men and women, independent men and women, of thought, of physical nature, all those things. So I would say stay-at-home moms are a gift to this world, and keep raising those kids.
You're doing the most vital work you could possibly doing at this day and age. That there's nothing better than what you're doing right now. And how anybody could look at that and see oppression again is beyond me. So keep doing your thing, Anastasia. Anyways, guys, that is Will and Amala Live without Will. But thank you guys so much for watching. Please like, subscribe, click the notification bell to be notified every single day when we go live at 2:30 PST, 5:30 Eastern. If you'd like to be texted when we go live, text the word live, L-I-V-E, to 41776. That is live, L-I-V-E, to 41776. If you'd like to listen to the podcast rather than watching it, you can go to Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or Google Play. Leave us a 5-star review to let us know that you like the show, but to also let other people know that you like the show so that they will too go and watch it. Also, we have a restricted documentary coming out very, very soon, so keep a lookout for that. And our new series called Making America with Dinesh D'Souza, a 5-minute video series that you can look at and read about with all of our founding fathers by going to PragerU.com and then clicking watch. Thank you guys so much for watching. We're going to be back tomorrow, hopefully with some more Will and some even spicier stories. See you guys.